This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions announces a run for his old Senate seat. A top diplomat revises his testimony to impeachment investigators. Virginia's status as a swing state might be over. And Apple pledges billions of dollars to ease California's housing crisis. That is just some of what we'll discuss today on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us to help make sense of this week's top stories is NPR politics reporter Tim Mak. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
Katie Rogers is a White House correspondent for the New York Times. Katie, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Philip Klein is executive editor of the Washington Examiner. He's also the author of Fear Your Future, How the Deck is Stacked Against Millennials and Why Socialism Would Make It Worse. Philip, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top story. So email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Let's start with the impeachment inquiry. And Tim, let's start with you, because a crucial witness in the inquiry revised his testimony this week. It was Gordon Sondland, who is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union. What had he said and what is he saying now?
Well, so what he's saying now is what's most important, right? That he is now saying that he has reviewed what had happened over the past year and now believes that there was some message provided to the Ukrainian government that there would be some sort of quid pro quo, that they would need to instigate or begin investigations into the Bidens or other issues related to the 2016 election in order for there to be either a White House meeting with the president or the release of military aid that had been approved by Congress.
And Tim, remind us how Gordon Sondland fits into all of this.
You know, he has become – so one thing that has emerged from a lot of these impeachment inquiry depositions and interviews behind closed doors is that there was a kind of formal diplomatic route between the United States and the Ukraine and an informal route between the United States and Ukraine. And Ambassador Sondland, who, you know, no one can mistake for, you know, someone who might be unfair against the president, he was kind of part of this informal diplomatic channel between the United States and Ukraine, and was apparently working with folks like Rudy Giuliani and Secretary Rick Perry in order to push the Ukrainians in order to kind of deliver a message from the White House.
Katie, how important is it that Gordon Sondland revised his testimony?
I think it establishes this idea of a quid pro quo, which has been at the root of this entire issue. I think also the reaction from the president's closest allies has been very telling. Sondland is a Trump donor. He's given money to the president. He is, as Tim pointed out, you can't mistake his support. But the boomerang since the testimony has been revised has been really notable. You saw Senator Lindsey Graham basically suggest that Sondland is now in cahoots with the Democrats. So the way that they're coming out full force against somebody who basically until this week has held the line shows you a little bit that they are taking this as someone who is serious enough to be sort of discredited.
Phil, this is regarding Gordon Sondland's testimony behind closed doors. Next week, the impeachment inquiry moves into public hearings. I'm pretty sure Sondland's new testimony is going to come up next week.
Yeah, I think it will. And it's important, I think, to think a little bit about the timeline, because it gets a little tricky. Because basically, the indications we have are that the Ukrainians weren't aware of this aid holdup until late into August, which was a month after the phone call between Trump and Zelensky.
Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine.
Yes. And in that phone call, Trump doesn't actually bring up the aid issue. And if you look at the text messages that have been released, which had State Department official Kurt Volker on them, and Sondland and Bill Taylor, who was the top diplomat based in Ukraine, as well as some Ukrainian officials, a lot of the discussion in the month of August revolved around this idea that the White House was, the Trump was dangling the promise of a White House visit to Ukraine in exchange for getting a commitment to the to investigate these areas, the Bidens and items related to 2016. So the question was always, well, when did aid come into play? So what came out from Bill Taylor's testimony and was later corroborated by Tim Morrison, who was another national security official in the White House, was the idea that in early September, it was communicated to Ukraine that the aid issue was tied to the investigations. And so Sondland's testimony, reversal of testimony, was key to sort of pointing that out. But it's important because a lot of these things get confused. Clearly on the call, Trump wasn't pushing the aid thing. But at some point, it was clearly communicated through back channels that, well, if they want to get the aid freed up, they should do this.
Tim, that is part of the argument that the White House has made, is that the request was not explicit in the direct call between President Zelensky and President Trump. That's going to come up next week for sure in the public hearings. Do we have any other sense of who would be testifying, when they'd be testifying, what to expect in the public hearings?
Well, we're expecting three public hearings next week. On Wednesday, William Taylor, who Phil mentioned, is expected to testify along with George Kent. He's a senior U.S. diplomat who oversaw a lot of policy in that region. And then on Friday, we're expecting to hear from Marie Yovanovitch, who's the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And there's been a lot of talk throughout this impeachment inquiry process about disinformation that was spread about Yovanovitch in order as part of a campaign led by Rudy Giuliani and folks in that unofficial diplomatic channel in order to force her out of her office.
How does it stand, Tim, in terms of the White House participating in this? It's largely refused, and the acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, is expected to defy a request, a call for him to testify. That doesn't seem like it's breaking at all for next week.
No, it doesn't. And the White House doesn't have a particularly active role to play in this stage of the impeachment inquiry. It'll have probably a more active role to play if and when this moves to the House Judiciary Committee after some of these open hearings in the House Intelligence Committee. The White House has largely refused to play ball with House Democrats as they investigate. And House Democrats have said, look, we're not going to deal with this in the courts or handle any legal challenges at this time. Given the schedule and the pace of the impeachment inquiry, we're just going to take your refusal to cooperate as evidence of obstruction and add that to the evidence in possible future impeachment articles.
Katie, the process of all of this is one of the big arguments that Republican members of the House have put forth, basically accusing the Democrats of rigging the process from the very beginning. Steve Scalise, the House Minority Whip, kind of compared it to a sort of Soviet-style hearing. What more do we know about the process, especially since, according to some reporting, the former National Security Advisor John Bolton might just testify?
What do we know about the process, according to...
In terms of whether Democrats and Republicans will be able to question the witnesses, what powers each side will have, like, has anything been done to try to make this process seem more fair, especially to Republicans who think the Democrats have kind of got it rigged from the dot?
Well, I don't think so. I think Republicans are largely following the messaging at the top, which is fall in lockstep behind the president and say this is a sham and a hoax and unfair, and it was launched before the transcript ever came out. I don't think as the public phase of the testimony starts to come out, I don't think that there's any sort of resolution that will be reached. I think that the White House is digging in even further.
Philip, I'd love your sense of this, too, because Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky joined the president in demanding that the press reveal who the anonymous whistleblower is. This is the whistleblower who raised concerns about the president's phone call with the president of Ukraine. Here's part of what Senator Paul said at a Trump rally in Lexington, Kentucky on Monday.
The whistleblower needs to come before Congress as a material witness because he worked for Joe Biden at the same time Hunter Biden was getting money from corrupt oligarchs. I say tonight to the media, do your job and print his name.
That was Senator Rand Paul speaking at a Trump rally in Lexington on Monday. Worth noting that there is no evidence of wrongdoing by Hunter Biden or former Vice President Joe Biden, at least not that NPR News has corroborated and confirmed. Ukraine's top prosecutor has also said there's no evidence of wrongdoing against either Biden. And on top of that, Philip, unmasking a whistleblower is illegal.
Yeah, I mean, there are some arguments over whether or not, you know, like the whistleblower laws haven't been totally challenged in terms of figuring out the definition of a whistleblower. So a lot of the argument is that this person didn't have primary direct knowledge and isn't entitled to the typical protections that would a whistleblower would have.
Yeah, but if I'm in a neighborhood and I call the police and I say, I think I hear gunshots, there might be gang members down the street, I don't need to tell the police who I am in order for them to investigate the gang.
But the issue is there are certain things that are subject to the whistleblower laws, and there is also a standard of feeling that you have the ability to confront your accuser. And so I think that the issue is that Republicans may have a point that Democrats are out to get Trump, but that doesn't also mean that Trump didn't do anything wrong.
There are a few more process questions. I want to get to that when we continue with Philip Klein of The Washington Examiner, Katie Rogers of The New York Times, and NPR's Tim Mak. We'll get to some of your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with NPR's Tim Mak, Katie Rogers of The New York Times, and Philip Klein of The Washington Examiner. We'd love to hear from you, too. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. And hey, by the way, if this impeachment inquiry story is getting confusing to you, as it is to me, thankfully, there is a very easy guide at NPR.org to help walk you through absolutely everything, who the players are, what documents have come into play, what the timelines are, what the accusations are. It's npr.org/impeachment. It's kind of a one-stop shop for all of the latest and kind of an episode guide for what's been going on. npr.org/impeachment. I want to get to some audience comments and questions in a minute, but Katie, with regards to the whistleblower, I wonder what the sense is of how that might play going forward. I mean, the whistleblower complaint had been our primary source of information mm-hmm. about what all had gone on. Now it's not. Now we have other sworn testimony
firsthand
and other evidence, right, that corroborates it. So it may, you know, it's possible that the whistleblower complaint might become less and less relevant as this goes on.
Well, I think what's interesting watching the president and his allies, like you know, Senator Paul, like you mentioned, focus on the whistleblower over the other and perhaps more problematic for them testimonies of people who were there, is they can sort of create a boogeyman. And in addition to saying the president continuously saying, where is the whistleblower? Where is the whistleblower? They have started to enter in questions about this person's motives, in addition to who they are. Ivanka Trump actually mentioned this morning in her trip in Morocco that essentially what her father has been saying is, you know, the bigger question is what the motivation is behind why this whistleblower came forward, more important than the identity. And the whistleblower's attorney has said, you know, why should political motivations matter in this at all if there was wrongdoing? So I think that part of the strategy, if you can call it that, is to sort of muddy the waters and deflect from the actual firsthand accounts and sort of focus on this unknown person. So I don't see that going away, I guess. Long answer, but it's a strategy.
That's okay. Long answers, I think, are very appropriate for this story because it's a complicated story.
It is complicated. And I think that when it is a really complicated story and a lot of Americans are tuning out, what the president is so good at is sort of latching on to one thing, hammering it. You saw it with Witch Hunt during the special counsel investigation into Russia. He's really good at sort of taking this question that really doesn't matter in regard to the larger situation and sort of focusing it on that.
Let me get to some of your questions about impeachment before we move on. We'll keep covering this story for sure, and feel free to keep sending us your questions about this story, 1A@WAMU.org. Alita in Illinois asks, and Tim, maybe you can answer this one. Alita asks, why is the House allowing witnesses to ignore the subpoenas? There should be a penalty to not fulfilling their civic obligation to respond to official subpoenas. Tim?
So, yes, you're legally obligated to respond to a subpoena from Congress. The issue right now is that some of the folks that have been subpoenaed by Congress are trying to seek a remedy through the courts, are asking the courts to make a ruling on whether they can appear before Congress if they're employer or former employer in the form of the White House is objecting to their appearing, right? There's this idea of executive privilege, which is this concept that the president should be able to have private conversations with top advisors, and that shields that sort of those sorts of communications from subpoenas or congressional oversight. So there's this kind of weighing and balancing between the congressional prerogatives and the White House's. That is going to take some period of time to sort out. If there are legal cases that work its way through the courts, that could take months or even longer than months in order to sort that process out. And the House investigators are simply unwilling to wait and see how long that might take. Their schedule is, hey, we'd like to move forward with open hearings and with some resolution to this process in the near future. And we're not willing to wait and see how long that legal process is going to take.
Michael emailed with a question, Philip, about something that you said a moment ago. Michael asks, how can your commentator say the issue of aid didn't come up in the call when the transcript itself shows Zelensky mentioning javelins, which are anti-tank missiles, and Trump responds with, we'd like a favor, though? Philip, care to clarify?
Well, I think that there's two things. One is that the aid, the issue that I was saying is that there was no indication the Ukrainians had that aid was being withheld. And you see this also from text messages that we've seen released, that there was a Politico story that came out in late August about the aid delay. And in that aid delay issue, Ukrainians were then surprised and sort of asking, well, what's up with this? And they said, you know, they had a call about it. And so he didn't make a threat like we're going to withhold aid or mention that aid was being withheld.
He didn't. I just want to go back to the document from the White House that they released of the call, because according to the White House's document, it's not a perfect transcript. The header of the document says it's not a perfect transcript.
But it's based on the notes
and recollections of people who heard it. According to this document, President Zelensky said, essentially, I would also like to thank you for your great support in the area of defense. We are ready to continue to cooperate for the next steps. Specifically, we are almost ready to buy more javelins, those anti-tank missiles, from the United States for defense purposes. And according to the White House's document, the president then says, I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. Then he refers to CrowdStrike, which has to do with sort of the theories about the 2016 election.
It's an unfounded conspiracy theory, to be clear.
Right. And then President Zelensky says, yes, it's very important for me and everything that you just mentioned earlier. We are ready to open a new page on cooperation and relations between the United States and Ukraine. So the president, you're right, Philip, in saying the president didn't say do this or else. But it's kind of clear that one was contingent on the other.
Yeah, but the only point I was making was that before the Sondland testimony and the Taylor testimony and Morrison testimony, what wasn't clear was whether Ukrainians were even aware that aid was being delayed. There's a difference between Trump mentioning it and, you know, it's important that the request regarding the favor had to do with the server and didn't refer to directly to Biden's. But, you know, you could argue it was part of the same favor because it was sort of there was back and forth. But The only point I was making is that in nowhere in the call is Trump saying we're delaying aid right now. I'm putting a hold on aid. That doesn't come up, and they weren't aware of that at the time of the call, is the point I was making.
Plenty more we can talk about with impeachment. We'll, of course, come back to this story. And feel free to send us your questions about this, and we'll get to it as the weeks go on. But we also should talk politics, because there was a lot to discuss with elections this week. Tim, Kentucky has been in the news quite a bit, including the governor's race. The race between the incumbent Republican and the upstart Democrat seems to have been either super-duper close or just enough to put the Democrat over the top. What's the latest on that? The incumbent has not conceded, as far as I understand.
Right. Governor Matt Bevin has asked for a re-canvassing of the votes. The latest count has the race between him and Democrat Andy Beshear at about 5,000 votes separating them, right? And so while it is true that if these results hold, Democrats will have won a really interesting race, in a state that's not typically considered one that would elect a ton of Democrats. You also have to point out, though, that Matt Bevin has been pretty unpopular in the state of Kentucky due to some face-offs with teachers unions in the state, and also if you look at all the down ballot races from AG on down, Republicans won those offices. So if we're trying to get a broader political message out of this, for example, is Mitch McConnell in trouble in his next reelection bid for Kentucky Senate? I'm not sure you can pull out that sort of message. It was a tight race with an unpopular Republican incumbent.
One thing about Bevin, though, that stood out to me in Kentucky is that these candidates who try to shape themselves in the image of the president with tough talk on teachers and, you know, wanting to decimate Medicaid using some pretty harsh language, that didn't work for him. And that is something that now Republicans are saying, yeah, he wasn't a great candidate. This doesn't say anything about the president. But in fact, these candidates are molding themselves behaviorally after the president, and it did not work out in that race.
Well, and Philip, there's one candidate who is tying himself very closely to the president, and that's Jeff Sessions, the former attorney general. He is running again. Here's part of what he said this week.
Are you running for Senate?
Yes, we'll file our papers tomorrow.
So you are running for the seat that you held?
It's not my seat in the Senate, but I believe I have something to give. I have some convictions that I think need to be pushed. We need to get some Republicans moving. They haven't been pushing hard enough to advance the Trump agenda. And so that's what I look forward to doing. And if I think I can contribute to that.
That's Jeff Sessions speaking to Fox News host Tucker Carlson earlier this week. Philip, I wonder what your sense is of not just his race, but how this might play out in terms of the association with President Trump going forward. Brenda wrote on our Facebook page, Jeff Sessions running for the Senate will cause some interesting mudslinging and hopefully help Doug Jones get reelected. Doug Jones is the incumbent Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of am doubtful that unless maybe Roy Moore somehow wins the Republican nomination, that Democrats are going to be able to keep that seat. You remember when Doug Jones ran, it was in an off-year special election, and you were running against Roy Moore, who had multiple accusations of sexual misconduct involving teenage girls. And so if you have just any typical Republican running in Alabama during an election year in which Trump's going to easily win Alabama, that's probably, I think, most knowledgeable Democrats would basically write off that seat. But I think it is interesting to see, when he ran, decided to run, Sessions' first announcement was a video just sort of that looked almost like a hostage tape where he's just affirming how great Trump is and how much he loves Trump. And that, of course, is a big liability for him because, Trump
blames him for the entire Russia probe going on like it did, you know?
Yeah. So it is difficult. I mean, you got to wonder what Sessions is thinking, because if Sessions never accepts being Trump's attorney general, he's basically senator for life. Like, as long as he wanted to be senator, he could have just stayed in the Senate in Alabama. You wouldn't have had Roy Moore. You'd never have Doug Jones in there. Mm-hmm. And he'd just be a defender of Trump from the Senate.
It's an incredibly interesting trajectory for Sessions, who is one of the Trump's first really vocal supporters, AG, now basically trying to get his old seat back, and the president is not going to aid in that.
Although there was a web video that Jeff Sessions released, a web ad, where he basically said, you know, a number of people who left the administration have been, you know, talking badly about the president. I've not done that one time because I support his agenda, and just kind of trying to make the point that's not his focus as he runs for Senate.
Just give me my old job.
Just give me my old job back.
Right? I mean, the important thing to point out, too, about Sessions is that he wasn't just an early endorser of Trump. He was almost the prototype for the Trumpian type of populism, right? Mm-hmm. The issues such as immigration and trade, when Trump was sort of erratically just sort of talking about that based on his sentiment, Sessions had been working on those issues in the Senate for a long time and occupying sort of a narrow caucus.
With the help of Stephen Miller, who's the primary architect of the immigration policy. Yes.
Tim, there were races in Kentucky and Mississippi, Louisiana, New Jersey, Virginia, a number of interesting wins and upsets. Were there any one or two big takeaways from the various races around the country this week?
Well, I really paid a lot of attention to Virginia and what happened there in Democrats taking control of the legislature there. One point that I kind of really honed in on was the ability of pro-gun control groups to outspend the National Rifle Association in those races. That's really been a sea change that shows how much influence has been lost with the National Rifle Association over the last year or two as it struggles with its internal problems and accusations of internal financial misconduct.
Let's talk about the presidential races. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Katie, has been under fire for a while in terms of her Medicare for All plan, particularly being criticized by other candidates for not having the numbers, for not being able to prove.
And Hillary Clinton, I think, said she's a great idea, but it won't get the votes.
Right. But she released a plan to pay for Medicare for All. What does that plan mostly involve, and did that relieve any of the criticism, any of the scrutiny?
Existentially, I'm not sure I do, because I think that the Medicare for All debate sort of sets up, it highlights the divisions, I think, among Democrats who are in the populist wing and people who are more moderate. I think that there are still questions about how to pay for it. I think there's in that part of the party, there's, you know, this is a great idea, but, you know, how are we going to decimate the insurance industry? Like, who's going to pay for this? I mean, I just don't think that those numbers are still there. And I think Warren is saying, you know, we have to at least come out and fight for this.
Philip?
Yeah. I mean, the plan that she put out was a joke. I think that a friend of mine, Peter Suderman, mentioned that it was nothing more than a plan to claim she has a plan. Multiple independent experts, including the Liberal Urban Institute, have pegged the cost of the type of system she wants at $34 trillion. She claimed that it would cost $20 trillion. The Urban Institute estimate, which it was $34 trillion, was already assuming a lot of administrative savings and a lot of cuts to hospitals already. And she claims she's going to get another $14 trillion off of that.
We'll continue the Friday News Roundup in a minute with Philip Klein of The Washington Examiner, NPR's Tim Mak, and Katie Rogers of The New York Times. Perhaps you're looking for something to watch this weekend. You might consider Sesame Street. It is about to start its 50th season. The show began as a tool to help disadvantaged children learn their numbers and their letters before they entered school. It's dealt with tough topics like diversity, homelessness, incarcerated parents, foster care, and living with HIV. This season, Sesame Street welcomes a new neighbor, Charlotte, an 8-year-old who's part of a military family. We'll have more from our guests and more of your questions in just a moment. Stay close.
I see, but it is not as good as a cookie. Oh, the moon sometimes looks like a sea, but you can't eat that. So,
C is for cookie, that's good enough for me. Yeah, C is for cookie, that's good enough for me. C is for cookie, that's good enough for me. Oh, cookie, 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 start with C.
Back now to the roundup with NPR's Tim Mak, Katie Rogers at the New York Times, and Philip Klein of the Washington Examiner. Philip, let me let you finish your thought, and then we'll keep going with politics.
Yeah, the point I was trying to make is that with regard to Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All pay-for plan, is that most independent analysts, including liberal Urban Institute, have pegged the cost of her type of plan at around $34 trillion. And they already account for various administrative savings and potential the ability to cut payments to doctors and hospitals, and they get $34 trillion. She comes up with $20 trillion. So right off the bat, she cuts 40% off of what everyone else thinks it's going to cost. And then on top of that, the amount of revenue she wants to raise relies on all sorts of unrealistic assumptions about how she's going to be able to tax the ultra-rich. And on top of it, things such as claiming that by fighting tax fraud, she could raise an additional $2.3 trillion.
You're saying unrealistic in terms of assuming that she can get it through Congress and so
no,
forth?
No, no, no. Unrealistic in saying that fighting tax fraud is not going to raise $2.3 trillion. And the Congressional Budget Office, which would actually be in a position to officially score any sort of budget plan, has only said that if you increase the IRS budget by more than a third, their enforcement budget, you'd only raise an additional $35 billion. So the $2.3 trillion number is just out of thin air, and that's just sort of emblematic of just the unseriousness of her proposal.
Glad to hear from some of you about this week's elections, including in Kentucky. Matthew in Covington, Kentucky, emailed, "As a Kentuckian with a boots-on-the-ground view of this week's election, Democrats need to understand Bevin's defeat was not a referendum on Trump. Bevin lost his re-election because of a perfect storm created by his fights with Kentucky teachers, a pension debacle, and his own smugness. When public officials don't seem to serve those they represent, they get voted out, as it should be." Worth noting, of course, that the governor, Governor Bevin, has not conceded that race, but I understand where Matthew's coming from. It still remains to be seen exactly who will be named the official winner of Kentucky's gubernatorial race. Katie, let's talk presidential politics a little more, especially since there's now a new name who might be running as a Democrat, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah. How many New Yorkers can we get into this entire election story?
Don't ask, because more will...
The limit does not exist.
You know what? If you ask that after the show, it'll be like, Jimmy Fallon's running? What the hell? Let's not tempt fate.
Yeah. Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, is said to be considering a run, particularly in states where filing deadlines are approaching. It's unclear whether or not he has taken this run, is taking this run incredibly seriously, but it should be considered a warning to Democrats like Biden that a billionaire does not seem to think that Biden is doing well at capturing prospective moderate votes.
Is this real, though? I mean, Michael Bloomberg has spoken in the past about how
he's flirted with it for years.
He's talked about how he has a more pragmatic, independent approach.
But so did President Trump.
Right, right. But I don't know how real this feels this time, or if it's just too soon to know.
I think it could be best read as sort of a warning flare. However, I think there are questions about who Bloomberg's constituents could actually be. I think that if you look at a lot of the younger, more diverse Democratic Party, they see somebody like Bloomberg as basically a Republican. Sure, he's against guns and is for, you know, climate change action, but he was a big proponent of stop and frisk, which is the New York City police edict that allowed basically the policing of minorities without warrant. So I think he is sort of somebody who raises a lot of questions about how effective he could actually be.
few stories regarding California and the media that we want to make sure to get to before our time is up. Let's start with California. President Trump and Governor Gavin Newsom traded some tweets this week, as they are wont to do. The president threatened to stop sending federal aid to California, demanding that Governor Newsom, quote, clean his forest floors, unquote. Newsom shot back, quote, you don't believe in climate change, you are excused from this conversation, unquote. Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris, who's California's former attorney general and now a senator, chimed in. Harris tweeted, quote, raking leaves is as effective at combating the climate crisis as your phone spell check is at fixing your tweets, unquote. Tim Mak, where's all this going? What is this rift about? And how possible is it that this could actually affect money that California really needs to fight fires?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, this is all happening in the context of the impeachment inquiry, a central question of which is, did the president use his power, as the occupant of the Oval Office in order to score political points or launch a political investigation? And, a similar question could be raised. You know, the president is the president of the whole United States, to include the state of California. And this idea that that he would cut off federal aid and have these kinds of Twitter debates with Democrats in California. It's an interesting fight to pick at a time when all these questions are already being raised about whether he's using his authorities and powers as president appropriately.
And we should also be clear that the fires that are burning in California are not forest fires. They're wildfires, which are different. So saying that bringing this into a context of California's care for the forests is a red herring, because these fires didn't start or are not being fueled in quite that way. But there's another climatological issue in California, and anyone knows, if you've lived there, that when the state isn't in a drought and at risk of fires, it's most likely being flooded. This week, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said that a dam in the high desert between L.A. and Las Vegas could collapse if there was an extreme flood. They raised the risk factor on the Mojave River Dam from low to high urgency, citing these performance concerns. And now the list of dams in California that are short of national safety standards is growing. Philip, it's projected that 300,000 people could be in danger if the dam fails. So it seems like the politics of climate change are rapidly turning into policy around climate change. Rubber is starting to meet road.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't speak with detail on the sort of the science of this, but the politics in terms of what President Trump is doing is quite clear, which is that he's not going to win California. California, it's a perfect target for him to sort of fire up his base. The base views California as this sort of left-wing crazy place, and so his idea of, you know, I'm going to get tough on California and, you know, not just fork over aid when they're completely incompetent clearly appeals to his base. And so Trump is very good, like Katie mentioned, the whistleblower, about choosing enemies and sort of attacking them relentlessly and picking them so that they sort of hit on certain, like, cultural touchstones. And mm-hmm. certainly sort of California environmental leftists is a clear, easy target.
And not to – and Speaker Pelosi is from California. Adam Schiff is from California. Uh-huh. There are personal problems, I think, personal grievances the president has with California, as well as very timely political ones.
Tim?
I think it also is a reminder, this issue of the dam is also a reminder of what might be possible for Congress and the White House to work on in more normal and less polarized times, right? Mm-hmm. That when Democrats took control of Congress, a major, major priority, which they thought that they could sell and pass on a bipartisan basis, was an infrastructure package. And now you hear nothing about it, that it is totally dead in the midst of all this impeachment investigation and pretty much nothing else happening on Capitol Hill. That one thing that the United States could use, and both Republicans and Democrats agree, is a big infusion of money for infrastructure projects in order to shore up some of these aging projects like this Mojave River Dam, which was, I believe, constructed in the 70s and needs work.
A few stories about the media cropped up this week that we want to get to before our time is up. On Tuesday, a video surfaced of ABC anchor Amy Robach from Good Morning America expressing frustration that the network quashed her interview with one of Jeffrey Epstein's accusers. There happened to be a hot mic nearby as she spoke to a colleague. The video was posted by a right-wing activist group called Project Veritas.
I tried for 3 years to get it on to no avail, and now it's all coming out, and it's like these new revelations, and I freaking had all of it. I'm so pissed right now. Like, every day I get more and more pissed because I'm just like, oh my God, what we had was unreal.
Katie, I'm not sure exactly what to think of this. I mean, partly there is the debate over coverage of Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, etc. On the other hand, there's a reason why news organizations edit before they publish. There's a reason why we're able to talk about things privately before we talk about stories publicly.
Right. Well, I think one of the more interesting offshoots of this whole scenario is, you know, the staffer who caught it is now at another network. And, you know, I think CBS is the network where this person allegedly is.
I think reportedly, yeah.
Then it became
supposedly,
let's say that. And then it becomes a matter of who caught this footage and why and where they are. And it detracts from, I guess, the core of what she was saying, which seems to be pretty concerning.
Another story about the media this week has to do with President Trump's backlash against the press, and it's had a ripple effect on a library system in Florida. Commissioners in Citrus County, Florida, recently met to discuss various county concerns, including one library's request for funding for a digital subscription to the New York Times. Here's how the commission responded.
Do we really need to subscribe to the New York Times?
Oh, I actually was going to say that. I'm going to be voting no for this. Fake news. Okay. I agree with President Trump. I will not be voting for this. I don't want the New York Times in this county. Okay. So I did second it, but just to have the discussion to say I don't agree with it. I don't like them. I don't. It's fake news, and I'm voting no.
Those were county commissioners in Citrus County, Florida. Those of you who've listened to this program know that I hate the term fake news because if it is fake, it ain't news. But Philip, the president's attacks on media outlets, right now it seems like they're having a tangible impact.
Well, I mean, I think that they are, but I mean, I think that the problem is that the media often makes massive mistakes. And you mentioned ABC and its supposedly high editorial standards that prevented them from reporting Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, during the whole Kavanaugh debate, they were willing to peddle and report on any allegation, no matter how slim. And they, you know, had on Michael Avenatti, the disgraced lawyer, who is the Stormy Daniels lawyer, who's now has subsequently been indicted. And the ridiculous accusations of Julie Swetnick, which were her story changed multiple times, had multiple holes. She was making wild claims that she witnessed Brett Kavanaugh in a gang rape ring in Maryland and so forth. And they didn't apply their supposedly high editorial standards to that, and yet they did for Jeffrey Epstein.
But of all the people who may be in a glass house to throw stones about accuracy.
Yeah, but the whole point is clearly Trump is, you know, a brazen liar. However, it also should be noted that the media gives him ample targets because they keep botching major stories.
But does that mean public officials should be able to say, based on their political beliefs, that a newspaper shouldn't have a subscription in a library system?
I think that a newspaper, that the library system should be open to all of those things. But I also believe in local control to make these decisions. But yes, I believe in open news and that we should use all of these views.
Tim, briefly?
Yeah, of course, news outlets making mistakes is not new to the Trump administration or the period of the Trump campaign or even before that.
Right.
I think that we One thing that is missing from this conversation is the role of social media companies, and also how many, many individuals are starting to turn to other sources, alternative sources of information in order to get their news, and that Facebook and Twitter have created these kind of choose-your-own-reality type situations where individuals can go out and find facts that support their opinions. That's really one of the major drivers behind why the New York Times might be considered by these commissioners to be banned from a library system.
Katie, you were trying to jump in?
Oh, no, I think I said what I wanted to, which was asking, you know, well, another point I want to make, too, is that by and large, when media and journalists at any reputable news organization, when we make mistakes, we correct them. And I can't really I don't know that we could say the same for a lot of the people making these criticisms.
Katie Rogers covers the White House for The New York Times. Katie, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Philip Klein, executive editor at The Washington Examiner. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you.
And NPR politics reporter Tim Mack. Tim, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Hey, remember, we are on Instagram. Follow us and check out our behind-the-scenes photos. We are at The 1A Show. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Chris Castano. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. And do send us your stories about dealing with testosterone, 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A. Thank you.